Part 2. The Lost Art and Science of Breathing. Chapter 3. Nose.
You look like shit, says Dr. Nyack. It's early afternoon, and I'm back at the Stanford Otolaryngology Lab. I'm splayed out on the examination chair while Nyack nudges an endoscope up my right nostril. Those smooth desert dunes I journeyed through 10 days ago look like they've been hit by a hurricane. I'll skip the details. Let's just say my nasal cavity is a mess. Now your favorite part, says Nyack, chuckling. Before I sneeze or can consider running away, he grabs the wire brush and pushes it a few inches inside of my head. He repeats with the left nostril, places the gunk-covered RNA brushes into a test tube, then scoots me out of the way. For the past week and a half, I've been waiting for this moment. I'd anticipated removing these plugs and tape to be a celebratory scene involving high fives and nasal sighs of relief. I could finally breathe again like a human. In reality, it's minutes of discomfort followed by more obstruction. My nose is such a mess that Nyack has to grab a pair of pliers and insert several inches of cotton swabs into each nostril to keep whatever is up there from spilling out on the floor. Then it's back to the x-ray, the phlebotomist, the rhinologist, and all the rest, repeating the tests Olson and I took before we plugged our noses. The results will be ready in a few weeks. It's not until I get home that evening that I can take a first full breath through my nose. I grab a coat and walk barefoot to the backyard. There are plumes of cirrus clouds moving across the night sky, as big as spaceships. Above them, a few stubborn stars punch through the mist and cluster around a waxing moon. I exhale stale air from my chest and take in a deep breath. I smell the sour stink of mud, the black label chapstick of the doormat, a Lysol whiff of the lemon tree and the anise tinge of dying leaves. Each of these scents, this material of the world, explodes in my head in a technicolor burst. The scents are so sparkled and alarming that I can almost see them, a billion colored dots in a Seurat painting. As I take in another breath, I imagine all of these molecules passing down my throat and into my lungs, pushing deeper into the bloodstream, where they provide fuel for thoughts and the sensations that made them. Smell is life's oldest sense. Standing here alone, nostrils flaring, it occurs to me that breathing is so much more than just getting air into our bodies. It's the most intimate connection to our surroundings. Everything you or I or any other breathing thing has inhaled is hand-me-down space dust that's been around for 13.8 billion years. This wayward matter has been split apart by sunlight, spread throughout the universe, and come back together again. To breathe is to absorb ourselves in what surrounds us, to take in little bits of life, understand them, and give pieces of our bodies back out. Respiration is, at its core, reciprocation. Respiration, I'm hoping, can also lead to restoration. Starting today, I will attempt to heal whatever damage has been done to my body while mouth breathing. I'll also try to ensure ongoing health in the future. To do this, I'll put into practice several thousand years of teachings from several dozen pulmonauts, breaking down their methods and measuring the effects. Working with Olson, I'll explore techniques to expand the lungs, develop the diaphragm, flood the body with oxygen, hack the autonomic nervous system, and reset chemoreceptors in the brain. The first step in the recovery phase is what I've just done, to breathe through my nose all day and all night. The nose is crucial because it clears air, heats it, and moistens it for easy absorption. Most of us know this. But what so many people never consider is the nose's unexpected role in problems like erectile dysfunction, or how it can trigger a cavalcade of hormones and chemicals that lower blood pressure and ease digestion, how it responds to the stages of a woman's menstrual cycle, how it regulates our heart rate, opens the vessels in our toes, and stores memories, how the density of your nasal hairs helps determine whether you'll suffer from asthma. Few of us ever consider how the nostrils of every person pulse to their own rhythm, how our noses open and close like a flower in response to our moods, our mental states, and perhaps even the sun and the moon. 1,300 years ago, an ancient text called the Shiva Swarodaya described how one nostril will open to let breath in while the other will softly close. Some days the right nostril yawns awake to greet the sun. Other days the left awakens to the fullness of the moon. According to the text, these rhythms are the same throughout every month and they're shared by all humanity. It's a method our bodies use to stay balanced and grounded to the cosmos and to each other. In 2004, an Indian surgeon named Dr. Ananda Bhavanani attempted to scientifically test the nostril patterns on a group of subjects. Over the course of a month, he found that when the influence of the sun and the moon was at its strongest during a full or new moon, the subjects consistently shared the same Shiva Swarodaya pattern. This shouldn't come as much of a surprise. Scientists have known for more than a century that the nostrils do pulse to their own beat, and they do open and close like flowers throughout the day and night. The phenomenon, called nasal cycles, was first described in 1895 by a German physician named Richard Kaiser. He noticed that the tissue lining one nostril of his patients seemed to quickly congest and close while the other would remain mysteriously open. After about 30 minutes to 4 hours, the nostrils switched, or cycled. The shifting appeared to be less influenced by the moon's mysterious pull and more by sexual urges. The interior of the nose, it turned out, is blanketed with erectile tissue. This is the same flesh that covers the penis, clitoris, and nipples. Noses get erections. Within seconds, they too can engorge with blood and become large and stiff. This happens because the nose is more intimately connected to the genitals than any other organ. When one gets aroused, the other responds. The mere thought of sex for some people causes such severe bouts of nasal erections that they'll have trouble breathing and will start sneezing uncontrollably, an inconvenient condition called honeymoon rhinitis. As sexual stimulation weakens, the nose becomes flaccid too. After Kaiser's discovery, decades passed and nobody offered a good reason for exactly why the nostrils cycled. There were many theories. Some believe the cycling helped protect the nose from respiratory infection and allergies, while still others argued this alternate airflow allows us to smell odors more efficiently. What researchers eventually managed to confirm was that nasal erections mirrored states of health. The nose would become inflamed during sickness or at other states of imbalance. If it became infected, the nasal cycle became more pronounced and switched back and forth more quickly. The right and left nasal cavities also worked like an HVAC system, controlling temperature and blood pressure while feeding the brain chemicals to alter moods, emotions, and sleep states. The right nostril is a gas pedal. When you're inhaling primarily through this channel, circulation speeds up and your body gets hotter. Blood pressure and heart rate all increase. This happens because breathing through the right nostril activates the sympathetic nervous system, that fight or flight mechanism that puts the body in a state of alertness. Right nostril breathing will also feed more blood to the opposite hemisphere of the brain, those areas that control things like logical decisions, language, and computing. Meanwhile, inhaling through the left nostril has the opposite effect. It works as a brake system. This nostril is more deeply connected to the parasympathetic nervous system, that rest and relax side that lowers temperature and blood pressure, cools the body, and reduces anxiety. Left nostril breathing shifts blood flow to the opposite side of the brain, to areas that influence things like creative thought, mental abstractions, and negative emotions. In 2015, researchers at the University of California, San Diego, recorded the breathing patterns of a schizophrenic woman over the course of 3 consecutive years. They found that she had a significantly greater left nostril dominance. This breathing habit, they believed, was overstimulating the creative part of her brain and causing her imagination to run amok. Over several sessions, the researchers taught the woman to breathe through her other opposite logical nostril, and she experienced far fewer hallucinations. Our bodies operate most efficiently in a state of balance, pivoting between daydreaming and reasoned thought. This balance is influenced by the nasal cycle and may even be controlled by it. It's a balance that can be gamed. There's a whole yoga practice dedicated to manipulating the body's functions with forced nasal breathing. It's called Nadi Shadhana. In Sanskrit, Nadi means channel, and Shadhana means purification, or, more commonly, alternate nostril breathing. I've been conducting an informal study of alternate nostril breathing for the past several minutes. It's the second day of the recovery phase, and I'm sitting in my living room, my elbows on the cluttered table, softly sucking in air through one nostril while limiting the air to the next. There are dozens of these breathing techniques. I've started with the most basic. It involves placing an index finger over the left nostril, then inhaling and exhaling only through the right. I did this 24 times after each meal today to heat up my body and aid in digestion. Before meals, and at any other time I wanted to relax, I'd just reverse this pattern, breathing only through my left nostril. These exercises felt great. Sitting here after a few rounds, I sense an immediate and potent relaxation, even a floatiness. Alternate nostril breathing appeared to have delivered these benefits, but these techniques, I'd found, were usually fleeting. The real transformation in my body over the last 24 hours came from another practice, letting my nasal erectile tissues flex of their own accord, by simply breathing through my nose. As I'm quietly contemplating all this, Olsen comes barging in. "Good afternoon," he yells. He's wearing a shorts and Abercrombie sweatshirt, and he plops down across from me while placing a blood pressure cuff around his right arm. This is the same position he's assumed for the last 11 days straight in pretty much the same clothes. Today, however, there's no bandage, no clips, no silicone plugs up his nose. He's also breathing freely through his nostrils, taking in easy and silent inhales and exhales. His face is flushed, he's sitting upright, and he's so keyed up with energy, he can't sit still. I figured some of our new bright outlook on life was psychosomatic until a few minutes later when we check our measurements. My systolic blood pressure had dropped from 142 10 days ago to 124. It's still a bit high, but just a few points from being in the healthy range. My heart rate variability increased by more than 150%. Olsen showed similar improvements. And there's potential for much more, because pulsing nasal cycles are only a small part of the nose's vital functions. Imagine for a moment that you're holding a billiard ball just a few inches from your face. Then imagine slowly pushing that entire ball inside the center of your head. The volume it would take up is equivalent to the total space of all the cavities and all the passageways that make up the interior of the adult nose. In a single breath, more molecules of air will pass through your nose than all the grains of sand on all the world's beaches. These little bits of air come from a few feet to several yards away. As they make their way towards you, they'll twist and spool like the stars in a Van Gogh sky, and they'll keep twisting and they'll keep spooling as they pass into you, traveling at a clip of about 5 miles per hour. What directs this rambling path are turbinates, the 6 bones that begin at the opening of the nostrils and end just below your eyes. The turbinates are coiled in such a way that if you were to split them apart, they'd look like a seashell, which is how they got their other name, nasal concha, after the conch shell. Crustaceans use their elaborately designed shells to filter impurities and keep invaders out. So do we. The lower turbinates at the opening of the nostrils are covered in that pulsing erectile tissue, itself covered in mucous membrane, a nappy sheen that moistens and warms breath while simultaneously filtering out particles and pollutants. All these invaders could cause infection and irritation if they got into the lungs. The mucus is the body's first line of defense. Like a giant conveyor belt, mucous membrane collects inhaled debris in the nose and moves all that junk down the throat and into the stomach, where it's sterilized by acid and then sent out of the body. More than 60 feet of mucous membrane make this journey every day. This is why nasal breathing is far more healthy and efficient than breathing through the mouth. As Nayak explained when I first met him, the nose is the silent warrior, the gatekeeper of our bodies, the pharmacist of our minds, and the weather vane to our emotions. The magic of the nose and its healing powers wasn't lost on the ancients. Around 1500 BC, the Ebers Papyrus, one of the oldest medical texts ever discovered, offered a description of how nostrils were supposed to feed air into the heart and lungs, not the mouth. 1,000 years later, Genesis 2:7 described, quote, "The Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul." A Chinese Taoist text from 8th century AD noted that the nose was the heavenly door and that breath must be taken through it. "Never do otherwise," the text warned, "for breath would be in danger and illness would set in." But it wasn't until the 19th century that the Western population ever considered the glories of nasal breathing. It happened thanks to an adventurous artist and researcher named George Catlin. By 1830, Catlin had left what he called a dry and tedious job as a lawyer to become a portrait painter for Philadelphia's high society. He became well known for his depictions of governors and aristocrats, but all the pomp and pretension did not impress him. Although his health was failing, Catlin yearned to be far away in nature to capture more real depictions of humanity. So he packed a gun, a few paintbrushes, and headed west. Catlin would spend more than 6 years traveling thousands of miles throughout the Great Plains, covering more distance than Lewis and Clark. He went up the Missouri to live with the Lakota Sioux. He met with the Pawnee, the Omaha, the Cheyenne, and the Blackfeet. Then he happened upon the civilization of the Mandan, a mysterious tribe whose members stood 6 feet tall and lived in bubble-shaped houses. Many had luminous blue eyes and snow-white hair. Catlin realized that nobody really knew about the Mandan or other plains tribes because no one of European descent had bothered to spend much time talking to them, to even live with them, or learn about their beliefs and traditions. "I am traveling this country, as I have said before, not to advance or to prove theories, but to see all I am able to see and to tell it in the simplest and most intelligible manner that I can to the world, for their own conclusions," Catlin wrote. He would paint some 600 portraits of 50 tribes and take hundreds of pages of notes. It was what famed author Peter Matheson would call the first, last, and only complete record ever made of the Plains Indians at the height of their splendid culture. The tribes varied region to region with different customs, traditions, and diets. Some, like the Mandan, ate only buffalo flesh and maize, while others harvested plants and flowers. They looked different, too, with varying hair colors and facial features and skin tones. And yet Catlin marveled at the fact that all 50 tribes seemed to share the same superhuman physical characteristics. In some groups, Catlin wrote that there were few men, quote, "at their full growth who are less than 6 feet in stature, and very many of them 6.5 and others 7 feet. They all seemed to share the same Herculean make of broad shoulders and barrel chests. The women were nearly as tall and just as striking. None of these people had ever seen a dentist, and yet their teeth were perfectly straight. As regular as the keys of a piano," Catlin noted. Nobody seemed to get sick, and deformities and other chronic health problems appeared rare or non-existent. The tribes attributed their vigorous health to a single medicine, what Catlin called a great secret of life. That secret was breathing. The Native Americans explained to Catlin that breath inhaled through the mouth sapped the body of strength, deformed the face, and caused stress and disease. On the other hand, breath inhaled through the nose kept the body strong and made the face beautiful. Healthy nasal breathing started at birth. Mothers in all these tribes followed the same practices, carefully closing the baby's lips with their fingers after each feeding. At night, they'd stand over sleeping infants and gently pinch mouths shut if they opened. Some Plains tribes strapped infants to straight boards and placed a pillow beneath their heads, creating a posture that made it much harder to breathe from the mouth. During winter, the children would be wrapped in light clothing and then placed at arm's length on warmer days so they'd be less prone to get too hot and start panting. All these methods train children to breathe through their noses all day and every day. It was a habit they would carry with them the rest of their lives. Catlin described how adult tribal members would even resist smiling with an open mouth, fearing some noxious air might get in. This practice was, quote, old and unchangeable as the hills, he wrote, and it was shared universally throughout the tribes for millennia. 20 years after Catlin explored the West, he set off again at the age of 56 to live with the indigenous cultures of the Andes, Argentina, and Brazil. He wanted to know if this medicinal breathing practice extended beyond the plains. It did. Every tribe Catlin visited over the next several years shared the same habits. It was no coincidence that they also shared in the same vigorous health, perfect teeth, and forward-growing facial structure. He wrote about his experiences in The Breath of Life, published in 1862. The book was devoted solely to documenting the wonders of nasal breathing and the hazards of mouth breathing. Catlin was not only a chronicler of these methods, he was a practitioner. Nasal breathing saved his life. As a boy, he snored and was racked with one respiratory problem after the other. By the time he reached his 30s and first went out west, these problems had become so severe that he'd sometimes spit up blood. His friends were convinced he had lung disease. Every night, Catlin feared he would die. I became fully convinced of the danger of the habit and resolved to overcome it, he wrote. Catlin forced his mouth closed while he slept and always breathed through his nose during waking hours. Soon, there were no more aches, no more pains, no more bleeding. By his mid-30s, Catlin reported feeling healthier and stronger than at any other time in his life. I at length completely conquered an insidious enemy that was nightly attacking me in my helpless position and evidently fast hurrying me to the grave, he wrote. Catlin would live to be 76, about double the average life expectancy at the time. He credited his longevity to the great secret of life, to always breathe through the nose. It's the third night of the recovery phase of the experiment, and I'm sitting up in bed again, taking slow and easy breaths through my nose. I'm not breathing this way out of some constant adult conviction, as Catlin wrote. I'm doing it because my lips are taped shut. Catlin suggested tying a bandage around the jaw at night, but that sounded dangerous and a little difficult, so I opted for another technique, which I'd heard about months earlier from a dentist who runs a private practice in Silicon Valley. Dr. Mark Berhenny had been studying the links between mouth breathing and sleep for decades, and he'd written a book about the subject. He told me that mouth breathing contributed to periodontal disease and bad breath, and was the number one cause of cavities, even more damaging than sugar consumption or poor hygiene. This belief had also been echoed by other dentists 100 years ago and was endorsed by Catlin. Berhenny also found that mouth breathing was both a cause and a contributor to snoring and sleep apnea. He recommended his patients tape their mouths shut at night. The health benefits of nose breathing are undeniable, he told me. One of those is that the sinuses release a huge boost of nitric oxide, a molecule that plays an essential role in increasing circulation and delivering oxygen into cells. Immune function, weight, circulation, all that can be heavily influenced by the amount of nitric oxide in the body. It's worth mentioning the popular erectile dysfunction drug, Viagra, works by releasing nitric oxide into the bloodstream, which opens the capillaries in the genitals and elsewhere. Nasal breathing alone can boost nitric oxide sixfold, which is one of the reasons we can absorb about 18% more oxygen than by just breathing through the mouth. Mouth taping, Berhenny said, helped a 5-year-old patient of his overcome ADHD. It helped Berhenny and his wife cure their own snoring and breathing problems. Hundreds of other patients reported similar benefits. The whole thing seemed a little sketchy until Ann Kearney, a doctor of speech-language pathology at Stanford, told me the same. Kearney helped rehabilitate patients who had swallowing or breathing disorders. She swore by mouth taping. "The first night I lasted 5 minutes before I ripped it off," she said. On the second night, she was able to tolerate the tape for 10 minutes. A couple days later, she was sleeping soundly. Within 6 weeks, Kearney's chronically blocked nose had opened up. "It's a classic example of use it or lose it," she told me. To prove her claim, she examined the noses of 50 patients who had undergone laryngectomies, a procedure in which a breathing hole is cut into the throat. Within 2 months to 2 years, every patient was suffering from complete nasal obstruction. Like other parts of the body, the nasal cavity responds to whatever inputs it receives. When the nose is denied regular use, it will atrophy. This is what happened to Kearney and so many of her patients, and to so much of the general population. Snoring and sleep apnea often follow. Keeping the nose constantly in use, however, trains the sinuses inside the nasal cavity and throat to flex and stay open. Kearney, Berheny, and many of their patients healed themselves this way, by breathing from their noses all day and all night. How to apply mouth tape, or sleep tape as it's also called, is a matter of personal preference, and everyone I talk to had their own technique. Berheny liked to place a small piece horizontally over the lips. Kearney preferred a fat strip over the whole mouth. The internet was filled with suggestions. One guy used 8 pieces of inch-wide tape to create a kind of tape goatee. Another used duct tape. To me, these methods were as ridiculous as they were excessive. Looking for an easier way, over the last few days, I conducted my own experiments with blue painter's tape, which smelled weird, and scotch tape, which crinkled, and band-aids, which were too sticky. Eventually, I realized that all I or anyone else really needed was a postage stamp size piece of surgical tape at the center of the lips. A Charlie Chaplin mustache moved down an inch. That's it. This approach felt less claustrophobic and allowed a little space on the sides of the mouth if I needed to cough or to talk. In the 3 nights since I started sleep taping, I went from snoring 4 hours to only 10 minutes. I'd been warned by Berheny that mouth taping won't do anything to help treat sleep apnea. My experience suggested otherwise. As my snoring disappeared, so did my apnea. I'd suffered up to 24 apnea events in the mouth-breathing phase, but last night I had zero. I had no creepy hallucinations, no late-night ruminations on Edward Gorey or anyone else. I never woke up needing to pee. I didn't have to, because my pituitary gland was finally releasing vasopressin. I was finally sleeping soundly. Meanwhile, Olson went from snoring half the night to not snoring a single minute. His apnea events went from 53 to zero. The bright-eyed, cotton-haired Swede I felt so guilty about abusing had been reborn. Earlier today, he was smiling, so convinced of sleep tape's healing powers that he kept a piece of it stuck to his lips for the rest of the morning. Sleep and life had become something that Olson and I embraced again. Now sitting in bed, with a little stamp of white tape stuck to my lips, I flipped the last page in Catlin's Breath of Life, the final paragraph he'd ever publish. "And if I were to endeavor to bequeath to posterity the most important motto which human language can convey, it should be in 3 words, shut your mouth, where I would paint and engrave it in every nursery and on every bedpost in the universe, its meaning could not be mistaken. And if obeyed, its importance would soon be realized."